When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
So welcome to the New Books Network podcast. Daniel and Alex, to talk about your book, Alien Sning. I'm neither an astrophysicist nor a music theorist, but I absolutely found this book so exciting and engaging. And I've been recommending it to like all my friends and coworkers because it's such a fun read. And I learned so much about what music is and what music could be for aliens. It's just been very fun. So I just want to start off thanking you for this work and making music theory so accessible and fun.
Thanks so much. Thanks for your kind words.
And you start this book by describing its origins were on a napkin since misplaced. And I'm wondering, even though topics and ideas can't really be pinned down to like a single moment or point, I'm wondering where the idea for this book came from and how you two started working together on it.
Go, Daniel. I always want to hear what you have to say.
Well, I remember that we met at a conference. So I'm in Hong Kong and Alex is in the States. So we met at a conference in Canada, in Vancouver. And I just said, let's have breakfast because I have no idea what you're doing these days, Alex. And so we had breakfast. I think it's your second breakfast, Alex. And so we started talking and then we sort of discovered that we have a mutual interest in things in space and intergalactic things and universal things, which is actually quite rare in musicology. And so we decided that maybe we should think of doing something crazy together. And I think, Alex, you came up with the idea of the golden record to tie all our thoughts together. And then I came up with a crazy idea that we should have an intergalactic musicological council, which never happened. But instead, we decided to write a book together.
That's right. I'd been teaching the golden record in sort of one big class. And, you know, we had, I mean, one semester long class on various forms of listening. And the golden record featured as, you know, one rather extreme kind of listening. And so, you know, I had a 1 hour lecture on it. And I always thought that there's much more to be said about the topic. And so, you know, after this conversation with Daniel, one thing led to another, and that's what came about.
An intergalactic music council, what would that look like? I feel like one of the things I was wondering is, will my IMTE commitment form actually get to that secretary general that you have in the book?
We have a lot of humor in the book. So yes, there is a commitment form because we want everyone to be, you know, music theorists. That's the most important thing. And so we want everyone to sign up for that. But obviously, if you set it off to me, I would reply to you, but probably as Buzz Lightyear, because I think that's the address actually that I put on that particular form.
I somehow imagine the council a bit like the cantina in the famous Star Wars scene. So, you know, it definitely has to have music.
I guess what were some of the issues and barriers that you see within like the music theory discourse? Because it doesn't seem like everyone is a music theorist. And that seems to be a big problem, like a big sticking point for you both in the beginning.
Not yet. Not everyone is a music theorist yet. You just don't know that you are. And that's part of the book. I mean, there is one scene early on in the book about the state of music theory. And I think it's quite comical when I first, you know, when we first worked out that chapter, that made me laugh. But there is actually a huge amount of work going on in the field of music theory right now. I mean, I think, you know, everybody recognizes that it is rather narrow or has been rather, and that, you know, people are really interested in moving the boundaries outwards. And so our book is kind of one contribution to those efforts.
I mean, we do give the music theorists a very hard time in this book, because we sort of chastise them for not thinking about the cosmos, because the music theory used to be all about the cosmos. It sort of shrank down into a kind of discipline that deals with very small group of canonical works. So we decided we wanted to blast that open. And so we were actually very rude, but we had a lot of fun being rude. So I hope all my friends are still my friends in music theory. That's the main thing.
We'll soon find out.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. I mean, I'm not, like I said, I'm not a music theorist, but I think, I mean, everyone, most people listen to music, most people like music and like to think about music. So I think that that's like important, you know, to like break that open and, you know, help people be able to analyze the type of music and go beyond just what our human centeredness is. And that kind of leads me to the question of like you point out that music theory and media studies in general are sort of very focused on humans, and that these things ought to be looked at using what you call like a flat ontology. Could you describe like maybe what that term means and sort of how we can sort of go back to that older cosmological sense of music theory, or I mean things in general even?
Yeah, so flat ontology, it's, you know, there are some efforts underway, you know, philosophy in science and technology studies and various fields that are kind of, you know, trying to link the humanities outwards, that are trying to rethink subject-object relationships and try to get beyond the old binaries. And one of the one of the really important models here is Bruno Latour's actor network theory, and you know, the idea of networks of agents coming together. And in some ways, the kind of flat ontology, the object-oriented ontology approach, tries to take it one step further. But you know, the basic idea is always that you know, traditionally you make distinctions between humans and objects, and the networking approach, whether it's with Latour or with OOO, is that we should level out those distinctions. And that doesn't mean that, you know, everybody is a thing. It can also mean that everybody has a certain element of life and agency. And so it's, you know, it's not that humans are being devalued, but the things that we normally consider to be lifeless are raised to the same level.
Yeah, basically, I think everyone is connected to everything. And that means that we really have to think in a different way, so that, you know, we don't make humans the kind of selfie in the middle of every bit of knowledge that we try to gain. And the music is very good for helping us to think in this very flat way. That's why we think that a flat ontology is one way of describing what we need to do if we're trying to think of music beyond what humans do.
And if I can just piggyback onto that, because I wanted to get back to the point that Daniel raised earlier, a little bit obliquely, about, you know, music theory's tradition, cosmological tradition, because, I mean, you know, the first music theorist is the mythical figure of Pythagoras, you know, who was incredibly influential for, you know, the first 1500 years of the discipline. And then he went out of fashion. I mean, there are good reasons for it. But this ambition of the Pythagorean worldview that everything is connected and that everything is music, because everything, you know, for Pythagoreans, everything relates to numbers, as does music, as does, you know, astronomy, as does, you know, geometry and arithmetic. And so some of that ambition is what we're trying to get back to. What we propose in the book is a slightly different model. So rather than Pythagoras, we offer a model that takes its starting point with Penelope, Odysseus's wife, who sits at home waiting for her husband, and she sits at the loom and weaves a shroud. And that's sort of the image that we use for our music theory.
Yeah, I thought that like music as a fabric was a very beautiful analogy. Like it's like weaving space-time together. It's almost like incorporating like general relativity, almost like the fabric of space-time, right? So I guess how does that like metaphor and myth sort of break from like the that like the previous theory of music using Pythagoras as the model?
Well, Pythagorean music theory is based on harmonies, based on tuning. So it's about these very simple whole number relationships. So when you divide the string in half, you know, you get an octave and so on. But we're proposing something completely different because the Pythagorean method is actually very restrictive. You know, you basically only have very beautiful integer numbers that go to count up to four. But in our view, music should be much more free than this. And we take as our starting point repetition. In other words, music is primarily rhythm. I think it's very hard to think of the music without rhythm, where it is possible to think of music without harmony. So I think the more basic aspect of music is rhythm. And once you're theorizing rhythm, you come up with a very different theory that looks something like this weaving of space-time that we talk about in our Penelopian theory. I don't know how you pronounce that word, of music, of the intergalactic music theory of everything.
I think that's a good point. I think like you come to this point a lot in the book, but I'm just wondering, or maybe like as a good summary question, would be like why is repetition so central to music, and sort of what is the relationship of music to repetition, and sort of how does that like differ, sort of like what's the role that difference can play in that?
Yeah, this is really where the golden record comes in. I mean, you know, the golden record is really the object that kind of, you know, ties our theoretical ideas together. And so, you know, just to recapitulate very briefly what happened in 1977, NASA shot a compilation of world music into outer space, pressed into the two sides of an LP that was gilded for protection against radiation and rust. And in its grooves, it has a lot of information. And you know, one thing that was really innovative about the project was that they included sonified images, they included music from all parts of the world, they included words, messages from UN delegates and various other people. And all these different kinds of, these different forms of expression were all pressed a sound. And that's, you know, I say that in scare quotes, because of course they're not sounds on the record. They're just wiggly lines. They're just part of the groove. And the problem that NASA never quite faced up to is what happens at the other end. I mean, you know, they did about as well as they could, but in the absence of knowing what kind of, you know, what species the recipients are, it's really hard to know much more than that. So what we have are just the grooves that carry data. And the data is in the form of frequencies. And frequencies are just repeated pressure changes in a medium like air or perhaps water or perhaps another liquid or gaseous medium. And so even at that level, you have repetition because in order to create a musical tone, you have to have repeated cycles of frequencies. And so we got rather taken by this idea of how, and you know, a different species, an alien civilization that is completely differently shaped than us, that has maybe different sensory organs, what they might be able to do with this information on the record. And listening with our ears would be the easiest way, but that's pretty unlikely that that they come out the same way. So really all we have to go on if we want to reconstruct Earth music from the ground up is repetition at various levels. And so that, you know, and we call the kind of temporal organization of music rhythm. And so that's really what it is, but it's really rhythm in an incredibly broad sense where, you know, where even a single pitch that constitutes of repeated cycles is some kind of rhythm that we just don't hear as a rhythm, but we hear it as a pitch. But really that's because of the way our ears are made.
Yeah, the key thing for us is that everything in the universe does actually repeat, because everything, you know, has cycles and oscillations, because it's just the nature of time and how things persist. So the idea for us is that music, in some sense, is about how time is made coherent through a process of non-identical repetition. In other words, things repeat, but they always repeat differently. And so the key thing isn't just about repeating the same thing. It's about how things change and how it's possible to have difference within repetition itself. So if you have that, you have basically all the components you need for an intergalactic music theory of everything.
You see, it's simple.
I wonder then how that makes, like, or if like any sound then, or any like repetition or frequency, is that music then?
Yes. In one sense. I mean, we actually did a little analysis of John Cage's 4 minutes and 33 seconds, which is basically just 4 minutes and 33 seconds of audience noise, and anything can happen in that space. But we sort of kind of showed, we try to show how that's actually a form of music based on repetition. So in a way, what we want to do is to extend the how we define music. If you don't want to think of it purely in human ways, then we have to think of music as something that happens, but sometimes we just don't hear it as music, either because it's a form of repetition that is beyond the scale of human hearing, but it's still there, it's still happening, or because we just, you know, categorize it as noise or things that we try to filter out. But as long as you focus on something that repeats, it is potentially music. At least that's how we think about it. So it's not just sound, it is actually music that is happening in the world around us.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. You talk about how sort of like how the music or the sounds and images on the Golden Record, without like any sort of context, that maybe that sort of like music is like loses its cultural context by not being tied to Earth anymore. So that almost makes me wonder, like, what's like missing from like the Golden Record, or like an alien listening to the Golden Record, like what are they really missing out on, or what do they have to sort of learn? You talk about like anthropology in a sense, that they have to like reconstruct human culture just from this one LP.
I know, that's always a really fascinating question. I mean, when they put together the Golden Record on Earth in record time, I mean, they did this in 6 weeks, which still seems superhuman to me. They were trying to be really good about representing Earth music, representing, or really world music, music from all the parts of the world, in about as fair and equitable a way as they could, given all the constraints they had. And at the same time, you know, one thing that I love is that the makers of the Golden Record really wanted the potential aliens to be music analysts, because music theorists, because they sort of gave little hints about how someone might approach a reconstruction of what was going on. And so one of the things that they were very keen on was to have multiple pieces by the same composer. And, you know, I mean, they were very interested in both Bach and Beethoven, and, you know, that's part of the upbringing, that, you know, there is a certain bias toward Western culture, but I think, you know, it's relatively small, given that, you know, this was in 1977. But they put in multiple pieces by Bach and Beethoven because they were hoping that this would make a useful basis for comparison. I think that's how they put it. But of course, you know, one of the things that's really interesting is that they assumed that the composer would be the unifying factor here. And, you know, that makes sense. That's how we normally think about music here on Earth. But of course, if you don't know anything about composers, about different musical traditions, that's a big leap. And, you know, there are other factors that seem much more obvious, like, you know, is it a fast piece of music? Is it a slow piece of music? Is it, you know, does it use high range, low range? Is it in multiple voices? Is it just one instrument? And, you know, those factors are so basic in some sense for our way of thinking that we kind of filter that out. Whereas if you don't have any other criteria laid out for you, that might well be something that becomes really important front. So all this is to say that we have no idea how alien cultures might reconstruct our human musical culture. And, you know, it'd be interesting to see. I mean, you know, in a best case scenario, if there in fact is an alien civilization out there, the earliest time that anything might happen is 40,000 years from now. So that would be long after Daniel or I are around to know what's going to happen.
Or our species, perhaps.
Or our species. Well, yes.
They're going to come here and like find your book and be like, oh, now I get it.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Alien. No, it's amazing how basically culture kind of disappears. That's why we say the book is really about what music is rather than what music means. Because, you know, once you go into the specific of meaning, then, of course, that's already lost the moment it goes into the kind of contextless areas of space. And so that's why we're focusing on repetition and the grooves of the record, as it were. And how can you construct something meaningful out of that if that's all that is given to you? But at least you would understand that there is intelligent life out there.
Yeah, I feel like the cover diagram, like detailing the directions and how to listen, seems so complicated as a human. I'm like wondering what assumptions were being made about aliens in these descriptions and symbols, and maybe even like what are the like technological or physical like limitations to the Voyager. Like I remember in one part of the book you talk like what like one side of the record has images and the other side has music, and like depending on like how an alien hears things, like maybe the image sounds like music. Or I'm just like wondering sort of like what assumptions are being made, and like what are the sort of like the limitations of like the physical aspects of the Golden Record.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, in all likelihood, they wouldn't know the difference. It could just, you know, I mean, those sonified images we hear as a low hum, as a buzz, because, you know, they're sort of just little sounds and then little silences where in the matrix you set dots and where you leave gaps. And so, you know, our ears are constructed in such a way that we hear this as a kind of hum or a buzz. But who is to say that, you know, for anyone who doesn't know anything else about music from Earth, that this wouldn't be some interesting kind of music? Or perhaps there are species out there who have sensory organs that automatically perceive those sounds as images. I mean, you know, it's an unlikely possibility, but it's, you know, but sensory organs can be constructed in all sorts of interesting ways. But yes, about the assumptions that are being made, it's just impossible to be, you know, to be careful enough. I mean, one of the things that has been pointed out a lot is the Pioneer plaque. So the previous mission that NASA sent out into outer space had a famous plaque on it with images, and it's quite iconic. I mean, you know, most people will have seen it at some stage. It has a naked man who raises his hand and a naked woman standing next to him with an image of the spacecraft in the background. And NASA got into huge trouble for depicting nudity, and so that was one of the reasons why they moved away from pictorial images and decided to send a sound object into outer space for their next mission. But even in the Pioneer plaque, there was a thing that they did that they thought was so obvious that turned out not to be obvious at all. They had a little representation of the sun and the nine planets. Pluto was still included at that time, with a spacecraft that, you know, was moving away from the third planet. And that was clearly the Pioneer spacecraft that, you know, with an arrow from Earth that was indicating it's moving away from Earth. And that seems so basic and so obvious to all of us that, you know, it really doesn't need any further explanation. But then anthropologists pointed out arrows really don't mean anything outside of cultures that know what bow and arrows are. And so there are all these kinds of assumptions that we just, you know, forget about because they seem so basic to our way of thinking. One other feature that a friend of mine pointed out a couple of weeks ago is that, you know, the sonified images are arranged as a matrix, right? As a rectangle. And, you know, it's very cleverly done with prime numbers so that there are very few ways in which you can reconstruct the image. But then the basic assumption is that you would want to turn it into a rectangle. And that makes total sense on Earth, where all our images, or, you know, the majority of our images are rectangular. We put them in frames. I mean, I have some behind me. And they're all rectangular because that's what a picture is. But there's really no reason why it should be rectangular, right? And we have no idea whether other civilizations would have the same kind of obsession with rectangles that we do.
And there's no reason why they would have screens either that can play back these things. It's like, well, you have to have some of the same technology already in order to have a look at those images. I think the wonderful thing is, this is Carl Sagan's team that sort of set up this brilliant idea of the golden record, is that they believe aliens to be better than us. I think that's a lovely idea, that they are actually superhumans, as it were, far more intelligent. And so really, this is a doddle for them. They can work all this out. And I think that's the assumption that is being made. And it's a good assumption in a way, because if you're going to do this, you might as well, you know, go for the best alien out there rather than for, you know, a slug or something. Not that I have anything against slugs, but even though there was a slug on another planet, you wouldn't send the golden record, right?
No, that's, I think that's a really important point. I mean, the whole project is so hopeful and so optimistic, and especially against the time when it was created, the 1970s weren't such a happy time with, I mean, certainly in America, you know, after the end of the Vietnam War, it's the height of the Cold War, and, you know, nuclear war seemed like a near certainty. And, you know, against all that, it's an incredibly hopeful project.
So kind of getting back to the slug idea, like one of the critiques that you have in the book is like, why not start communicating on Earth with other species like slugs and dolphins before we move on to more ambitious intergalactic communication?
Yeah, I mean, people have tried. We haven't gotten very far yet. You know, I mean, the critics of SETI, of the study of extraterrestrial intelligence, said, you know, we haven't even gotten to that simple part. So why don't we just start there? And again, it's sort of a question of attitude, right? I mean, there are some famous experiments. I mean, you know, primates, you know, there is Alex the parrot, there is there are famous series of experiments also from the 60s and 70s with dolphins. So, I mean, you know, all this is relatively early on, I guess, and who knows where this will go. I mean, you know, I don't want to give up hope yet.
I think one of the nice ideas that, you know, we've learned from the attempts to listen to other species as if they were musical is that we have an amazing imagination as humans. So, for example, we would be, you know, listening to, you know, whale sounds, and we would call it whale song, and we have no idea, absolutely no idea what's going on, what it means, and what they're doing. But somehow it speaks to us still, right? So even though we have no idea what it is and what it means, it still means something to us. And it helps us actually think of whales in a different way. In fact, I think the record of, you know, the whale song actually helped save the whales in the 1970s from being hunted to extinction. So there is something about that non-communication, of that non-contact, or at least the kind of failed contact, that still allows us to theorize or think something about another species that can connect us, even though, of course, it's not a direct connection in any way. And in fact, we've probably misunderstood everything.
I feel like that reminds me of, I think you're careful not to say that music sort of is the, like, is a language even. Like, the point isn't necessarily translating or communicating in that sort of language-y based way. But that kind of makes you wonder, like, what is the relationship of music, like, to communication? Like, beyond repetition or, like, embedded with culture or separate from culture, like, over-explaining myself, sorry.
No, it's a great question. At the same time as the Golden Record was sent out in 1977, that was also the year when the movie Close Encounters of the Third Kind came out. And there's, of course, the iconic scene where contact is made, communication is made with music. And apparently Carl Sagan hated the movie except for that scene. And I think, you know, there is, at the very basic level, there is a sense that deliberate communication is happening, right? If you repeat patterns, and, you know, on one level, that's all that music is, then you are communicating, and you're creating a connection. Everything else beyond that becomes more complicated, but that basic fact is something that music does really well.
And music is very scalable in this sense, because, you know, if you're just working in terms of different rhythmic patterns, you can scale it to whatever, you know, your receptors need to, you know, whatever bandwidth your receptors operate on, because we're assuming that different species have different bandwidths on the sort of spectrum of repetition. I think one of the important things for us is not really to claim that music is universal in a way that is transparent. The key thing for us is we're trying to come up with a theory that explains how this might or may not work. What are all the different things you need to have in place? So yes, there's repetition, but at the same time, there's media. And media just creates a completely new thing, because every time music goes through a different media, it will change. And at the interface, things either connect or they don't connect. These are like filters that kind of scramble meaning in different ways. So making that handshake is actually extremely difficult to do. But if you miss the handshake, it doesn't mean it's a disaster. Something amazing can also happen. It's just not going to be a seamless transmission of one music from one species to another. So what we're trying to do is to explain that process. And in explaining that process, understand what music is and how it works.
So if NASA or if SETI were to put out Golden Record 2.0, what sort of recommendations would you have for them?
That's super hard.
I know. I'm sorry.
No. We've spent so much time thinking about that question. I can never come up with a good answer, because including one thing always means excluding so many other things. And, you know, I want it all to go on there. You know, I mean, there are certain things that people have pointed out that they didn't, you know, certain omission from 1977. And so, you know, I mean, there are some white gaps on the map of music. There is nothing from the Middle East. There is nothing from the Caribbean. And, you know, we tend to think that those are important musical cultures that probably should be included. Then there are certain temporal elements in that, you know, like hip hop rap is now a huge genre. It was sort of just coming up, bubbling up in various urban centers at the time, and it wasn't included. So I think those are some things that probably should go on the rebooted version. And then, you know, everybody has their favorites.
It's an impossible question. I think the important thing is, you know, the Golden Record is just trying to capture a slice of time, 1977, because that's all you can do. And in a way, that's all we can do, because, of course, they didn't really have hip hop at that time, right? So, but now we can capture, if you want, you know, 2021. But, you know, every year will be different. There's no way we can get all that information across. But I think the really cool thing is they managed to do it on a record, on a mechanical thing. I think, I don't know what we'd do today, because I think it's much harder if you were to send, you know, a bit of digital data out into space for an alien to decipher. So that sort of sense of a physical object in space means much more than, in fact, our technology today, if you want to send that. Because I think we have sent all kinds of stuff, you know, into space, but it just doesn't seem so romantic or so meaningful because it doesn't have that wonderful object, you know, that we've made that's being sent out there.
They're playing our song.
That is sort of like a time capsule, like that the Golden Record is a time capsule. And I guess, is any piece of music or is any piece of art even sort of like stuck in a moment? And like, kind of, if so, what, how does like the implication of like re-listening or repeating that event, be it a piece of music or art or a book? Does that question make sense? I don't know.
yeah, absolutely. Okay. It's a tricky one in a way, but I think, you know, things that artworks or pieces of music that don't get any further because either it's really bad or it never got out. I mean, they're the things that remain in that moment, right? They will never be heard of again. They will fossilize, and maybe they will be found in some sort of technological form in the future, if you're lucky, but it could just be lost. But things that repeat in any way will always time travel. That's the point that we're trying to make. And when things time travel, they always change. Because it goes through different media. And so in that sense, all music, all artworks, in a sense, are like the Golden Record. And they're moving away in ways that become more and more alien as they travel in time, and often also in space now, because, of course, we're, you know, a big globe, a global world. And the more we repeat these things, the more we are familiar with them and we make sort of cultural meaning out of them. But the less we repeat them, the more they become kind of fossilized. And if they're rediscovered again in hundreds of years' time, they become these alien objects that we have to decipher. So it's a little bit like the Golden Record. So I always think that when we try to decipher very ancient music, it's a little bit like what aliens would have to do. They would have to reverse engineer whatever thing, artifact, document that they have in order to try to get at what this music might be like or sound like.
That was beautifully put. I have nothing else to say. I think that's great.
I guess maybe starting to wrap up, I'm curious as to like what, like you mentioned, Alex, like your the favorite track on the record. Like what is your favorite one?
Oh, that's another really hard question. I mean, you know, there is so much to love. I think there's one, you know, I mean, the Golden Record creates this, I mean, admittedly very small cottage industry, but there are some really great books out on the Golden Record. And one person who I really admire is Michael Anthony Moreno, who wrote a short, rather poetic book on the Golden Record. And he's an American who moved to Israel several years ago, and he's not Jewish. And so there is, you know, he did feel a little bit like an alien. And so, you know, part of the book is about, you know, negotiating life in Israel, but also during that entire time, he had the Golden Record on his playlist, and that's all he listened to for, I forget how long, but a very, very long time. Probably many more times than Daniel and I have listened to it. And I think, you know, there are different songs that stand out at various times. I mean, I've been quite interested in, let's see, which pieces do I go back to? There is Flowing Water, which is a piece of Chinese music. It's for a traditional instrument, the qin, the guqin, which is a sort of, you know, it's a very refined, very quiet instrument that was favored by the educated classes in Imperial China. And you played it for yourself. It was, you know, very much about contemplation. And that's a piece that I go back to. It's also by far the oldest piece on the Golden Record. I mean, you know, it goes back, I think, to the spring and autumn period, so very, very old. So in legend, that's when it was supposedly created by a legendary chin player. The first notated version that we have is still, you know, if we want to go by the documented age, I think that's still in the 15th century. And so, you know, even by that stage, it precedes all the Western music that starts on the Golden Record, that starts a little later with the English Renaissance. And so that's a piece I go back to for various reasons. I think, you know, I think the Beethoven Cavatina, the last piece, is clearly the standout on this. And I'll let Daniel talk about that because there's a beautiful story attached to it.
Yes. I think the favorite piece for the people that put the Golden Record together, and that would be the last piece that they had, which is Beethoven's Cavatina from one of his late quartets. And they made it very special because they also included on the other side, as it were, whether you have the images, an image of the score of this work and a little a violin, and also an image of a string quartet. So there are almost three items there that are very closely interconnected. They wanted the aliens to really understand this. This is a great piece of music, but it's also a piece of music that much loved by Andruin, who at that time fell in love with Carl Sagan. And so, in fact, they sort of declared their love for each other during the making of this record. And in fact, she also recorded her brainwaves whilst thinking of Carl Sagan. So, you know, sort of love is in the air across the Golden Record. But this is very much their song, the Cavatina, in some way. And so having it there at the end with all this kind of photographs to go with it and so on is something very special for them. So it's really a bit of their sort of their love letter, as it were, in music sent into space. But I wrote a whole book on Beethoven's late string quartets. So of course that piece is also very special to me and to many, many people, because it's an extraordinary piece. But the main thing I think about the Golden Record is that the people who put it together all sat down and listened for a very long time to many, 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 many different pieces of music. I mean, and they decided they would choose pieces of music that they all loved. So actually every single piece on the Golden Record is an amazing piece of music. And none of it is sort of chopped up. It's not an excerpt. It's a whole piece or whole movement they've included in there. So there's a great deal of aesthetic integrity, you know, and that's the kind of love that's really in this record, not really Andruin and Carl Sagan, but there's just the love of putting their favorite music, the music they've been listening to in the most beautiful way possible on this most beautiful object.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember part of your book, you described sort of like the intimate act of making like a mixtape for like your crush. I think that sort of like what you both described there is that this is like very much a labor of love. Like we hope that the whoever listens to it will catch those feelings.
Absolutely. I think the idea of the mixtape is really important. I mean, it's the wrong medium, right? It's an LP. But at heart, it's a mixtape because, you know, as you say, it is the labor of love. And what you do with a mixtape is it's a very intimate gesture. It takes a long time. It's hard work. And you give something very personal away about yourself and give it to the other person and open up to their interpretation. And that's exactly what's happening here.
And of course, you travel with mixtapes. You know, you put it in your car at that time, all your favorite music when you drive really fast. But I'm just surprised that people still know what mixtapes are. You know, I'm thinking, wow, you know, are we just talking to the wrong generation? But anyway, it seems that everybody knows what a mixtape is still. And I think it's a wonderfully nostalgic sort of format now. But it's so cool that they send a mixtape into space to send love to the alien. And I think that's the other important thing about the Golden Record. You know, it's a completely non-violent gesture that we're sending out to the universe. I think the point that we make at the end is, well, we don't know whether the universe is a meaningful place of peace, but if you were an alien and you discovered this Golden Record, you probably think, oh yes, this universe is peaceful.
I also love the pun that you make. You're like, oh, we come in like peace, like music peace. That got me every time. I love that. sort of as a last question, at the linear end of your book, you have a repeat, but I wonder what the sort of like the next event has been for you, or like what new repetitions that readers could be on the lookout for you both. Or if it's a non-book, you know, what's the next project? That's what I'm going to ask.
Well, funny you should say that, because we are, I mean, you know, the book only just came out. And I think, you know, I think we're still a little bit in recovery mode, but we are inching our way toward another topic that's equally big, but much less fun in some ways. It's about the question of the Anthropocene, and you know, the question of, you know, what music's role is in understanding climate change. And you know, I mean, we are at the beginning of this, but the question of temporality and repetition are also really important there. And that's where we are at the moment.
Yes, I mean, we did think about doing a pop-up theory of music, yes. Harmony book, so the things popping up on the page, because we were thinking of all these crazy objects. But I think that we're going to put that on the shelf. So yeah, I think something like Alien Listening helps put Earth in perspective. And so when we're thinking about these bigger timescales, I mean, the Anthropocene obviously is a kind of geological timescale, and thinking about objects rather than subjects, it sort of naturally leads us to think more about where we fit in these kind of biggest timescales, and these questions about climate change and our species and the role of music there. And once you have a much bigger concept of music, you can begin to think in this kind of way about the Anthropocene. But these are very nascent thoughts at the moment, which is sort of, it's emergent, let's put it that way. It may come together. But the great thing is, Alex and I have great fun writing, because we sort of push up each other into areas of craziness that we wouldn't normally do. But I think we should be more sober in this book. Yeah. Slightly more sober, just a slightly different tone. But yeah, so that's the plan anyway.
Yeah, I guess we have to keep Earth around if we actually want to meet the aliens that get to hear the golden record. So that sounds exactly like a good piggyback off of this book for sure. Well, cool. That's all the questions I had. Thank you both for taking the time to discuss this book with me. It's definitely a pleasure.
Thank you so much.